Venezuelan streets teeming with protesters. Government forces are violently cracking down on them across the country. At least 8 people have died so far, including a young beauty queen named Genesis Carmona, who was shot in the head during a protest. The intense situation in Venezuela has been mostly overshadowed in the U.S. media by the violence in Ukraine. To shed some light on the story, we called Juan Cristobal Nagel. He edits the Caracas Chronicles, an English-language blog on Venezuelan politics, and he's also co-author of the book Blogging the Revolution. And I asked him how this recent violence began.
Well, Venezuelans have been enduring a series of problems in their daily lives for quite a few months now. We have one of the world's highest inflation rates, one of the world's highest crime rates. And what really triggered all this was a series of protests by student leaders regarding crime in college campuses. This triggered a backlash on the part of the government where they imprisoned some of the student leaders. And so the protests started spreading all over the country. Political leaders started chiming in, and basically the population has sort of outpoured into the streets to protest about all these things and about the government's seeming inability to tackle these issues.
And meanwhile, you have a government that is clamping down on street protests, on expressing any form of opposition.
Yeah, so the most troubling aspect, there's two troubling aspects about what's been going on recently. One is the use of paramilitary motorcycle bike gangs that are clearly government-sponsored to taunt the population, to scare people into not protesting, and in some instances to use targeted violence. So that's one aspect of the situation. The other aspect is the media clampdown. So we've seen a government that in the past few days has censored the internet. They have censored Twitter, according to Twitter itself. They have censored a few all-news cable channels, and also local TV stations are heavily self-censoring their broadcast of the situation. So you have the both ends of the story. You have some repression, but you also have Venezuelans finding it seemingly difficult to be informed of what's going on.
And meanwhile, the world's media is focused on what's happening in Ukraine, which admittedly is a much larger problem with a lot more violence on the part of the government forces against the protesters. But is the world media missing the story?
Well, I think they took a little while. They've been slow getting on top of the story. For a while now, the story on Venezuela has been of a simmering sort of truce between two warring factions, with the government always having the upper hand, but not really spilling out into the streets. That's slowly changing. And so now that the media is realizing that we have a situation where there's barricades all over the country, where people are protesting and are not backing down, I think the media is getting on top of this story a little more. But you're right. I mean, the situation in Ukraine and also the situation in Thailand is taking up a lot of the media's attention. These are completely different situations, obviously, and the geopolitical implications of each country are obviously very different. But I think that they're slowly getting on top of this.
And give us a little background on the president, Nicolas Maduro. He was the handpicked successor of Hugo Chavez, who died a year ago, and he won in a narrow election last April. Tell us about him. Is he carrying on the same policies as Chavez?
Well, the thing you have to know about Maduro is that he won by a razor-thin margin in an election that was bitterly disputed by the opposition. And in fact, the audit that the opposition requested of that election never took place. So there's a real sense of him not being legitimate in the eyes of many in the opposition. He is the chosen elector of Hugo, the chosen successor of Hugo Chavez, but he doesn't have any of his charisma, and he doesn't have any of his media savviness. And so what we've seen in the last few days has been that Maduro has been trying to compensate that lack of charisma or savviness with a heavy hand in dealing with the protests. And so that is the reason why protests are being met with much more force than what Venezuelans were used to during the time of Hugo Chavez.
And the opposition leader, one of the main opposition leaders, Leopoldo Lopez, he's now in prison. Tell us about him. Is he very popular?
Well, Leopoldo is a personal friend, actually. I've known him for about 20 years. I feel terrible for what he's going through. He's a very smart, charismatic leader. He's kind of a radical in the sense that he's much more forceful in his opposition to Maduro and to the whole Chavista system than other opposition leaders have been in the past, particularly Mr. Capriles, who was the candidate from the opposition that contested the election against Maduro. López is very smart, Harvard educated, and he's also very cunning. He's a very able politician. And he sort of boarded the whole protest movement sort of after the fact that they started. But he's been very forceful in supporting the student protests and being like a spearhead in terms of talking about how Venezuelans needed to go to the street to protest against this government. I had a conversation with him 2 months ago in which he told me that one of the mistakes of Capriles, who was the losing candidate in the April election, was that Capriles sort of backtracked from calling people to go to the streets and protest a contested election. And he felt that that was a mistake. And so he felt that this was the way to go. And sadly, he's paying the price for it. He's now being charged with inciting hatred and other sorts of manufactured alleged crimes that he's been put in prison for.
Right. And any sense where the United States is on this? The U.S. obviously was not a fan of Hugo Chavez's.
Yeah, well, the government is always alleging that the United States is behind all of this. You know, those kinds of allegations don't carry much water, in my opinion. This is a very organic protest movement. It's happening all over the country in large cities and in smaller cities. It's hard to see what role the U.S. is playing in all of this. You know, just from talking to protesters themselves, there's a lot of real pent-up rage against the quality of life and the problems that Venezuelans are facing in their day-to-day lives. And they don't need the U.S. to tell them what to do. They're protesting out in the streets because they're really unhappy with what's going on. So obviously the government is going to play that Trump card, which is a very classic excuse in Latin American politics. Personally, I don't buy it. I don't see they haven't shown any evidence of the U.S. being involved in any of this. And what the U.S. is calling for is dialogue, which is what really needs to happen if this is going to be diffused.
Juan Cristobal Miguel edits the Caracas Chronicles. It's an English language blog on Venezuelan politics. And he's also co-author of Blogging the Revolution, Caracas Chronicles, and the Hugo Chavez Era. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Turning to another part of the world now, Sochi. We're going to talk about today's big Olympics news, so I'm issuing a clear spoiler alert. If you don't want to know what happened in the hockey or women's slalom today, tune back in about 7 minutes from now. Okay. All right, on to the Olympics news. You've been warned. Good and bad for the Americans. Bad first. Canada defeated the United States in men's semifinal hockey. The score was 1-0. Canada will play Sweden for the gold on Sunday. And now the good, 18-year-old Mikaela Shiffrin won the gold in women's slalom. Joining us to talk about today's news and the controversy over last night's women's figure skating is Stacey St. Clair. She's a reporter with the Chicago Tribune. Welcome back, Stacey.
Thank you.
Well, last we talked, you and I, you were warned not to put the water on your face. Has that resolved itself?
Right.
I just want to know.
That has resolved itself.
Okay,
I've been
good.
Able to, well, I put water on my face, whether I was supposed to or not. No, it's fine. Everything's worked out.
Okay, no face is melting or anything like that. Okay,
no.
let's talk about the men's hockey. Was it a shocker the U.S. didn't win or not?
I don't know if it was a shocker. I mean, Canada is doing what Canada does, and that's winning at hockey. So I don't know if it was so shocking, but the U.S. really didn't play a great game. It was sort of a lackluster, affair. It was 1-0, and you know, if you're not going to score on Canada, it's just not going to happen. You know, you're
yeah.
not going to shut them out. So there was no hope for an overtime shootout in that
right.
case.
Right. So nothing like the women's hockey, which the U.S. also lost.
Right. That was a little bit more heartbreaking and then a little bit letting that slip away. The U.S. Just didn't control this game and Canada did.
Okay, so not a shocker that Mikaela Shiffrin won the slalom. She was
right.
the favorite.
Yes, she was the favorite. And the men's slalom, you know, she could be our last skiing medal, the men's slalom. We don't have as strong of a competitor in that event. So, yeah, that was a big win on the hill for her, and big win for the United States in terms of the medal count, because that tied the number of Olympic Winter Games gold medals outside the U.S. To be very specific.
Okay, that is very specific.
But they're one away from tying the number of gold in Salt Lake City, which is the record. So,
okay, so the U.S. is doing pretty well. U.S. is doing pretty well in the medal count then.
Yeah, I mean, I know there's a lot of worry, you know, early in the games about, you know, where they were in the medal count. But as long as there's, you know, the extreme sports, stuff like that, we'll end up doing okay always.
Right, right. Well, not so good in skating. The U.S. just did terribly in skating. I don't think they haven't won a medal. This is the first time I think they've been shut out since 1936 in singles figure skating.
It was really disappointing, I think, for the U.S. figure skating team. And, you know, Ashley Wagner talked a little bit about the judges and sort of felt the judges had did her wrong last night. And there are people who definitely agree with her on that end. She skated a clean program. She still finished seventh. There are people above her who fell. So I can see where she's coming from. Afterwards, she said, you know, if the sport wants to, you know, grow its fan base, it has to have some accountability in its judging. And I think that's sort of going to be the message taken away.
Yeah.
Not just the American skaters, but with figure skating in general here.
Right. And the big scandal, or scandal, I should say, the big controversy is who got the gold last night. The Russian skater Adelina Sotnikova won, and everyone expected Yuna Kim from South Korea to win. And let me just play a clip of tape of the commentators reacting. This is Terry Gannon and Johnny Weir reacting right after Sotnikova got her scores.
Wow. Now that is surprising.
That's a very big number, and you have to think that being in Russia in front of a Russian audience has definitely helped. She skated well. I don't know if she was 8 points ahead of Carolina Krosner, but definitely a well-deserved lead at the moment.
Okay, so referring to the fact that the audience was going wild for her performance, does that influence the judges?
I don't know if it influenced the judges, though, but like I was in the arena when that happened, and I'll tell you, it influenced me. It made her performance just feel that much more electric because the crowd was going crazy, and the atmosphere was just sort of crackling. And then she's just nailing jump after jump, and you sort of, at one point during the program, I thought, wow, this is incredible pressure. This is an incredible performance for her to be throwing this down with this crowd's expectations weighing on her. So I don't know what the judges, but I'll tell you, I felt it.
Yeah, yeah. And so most people did expect Yuna Kim to win. And so really what happened? Because Sotnikova, she did make a mistake in her performance. It wasn't flawless.
She did. It wasn't. Right. She had a two-footed jump. She did have one extra triple jump than Yuna had. I think the real controversy comes in this thing called component scores, which, for lack of a better description, are kind of what we were used to for the artistic scores. Remember back in the old 6.0 system?
Yeah.
And they're completely subjective. And that's where Adelina got a lot of points that perhaps she didn't deserve. If you want to have her beating Yuna on the technical, I don't think anyone's going to argue against it. To put her close to Yuna on the component scores, the artistic type scores, is a little bit shocking. Last night I spoke with Wendell Pizarot, who is the French gold medalist in ice dance from 2002, and he was part of that whole scandal, not him personally, but he was one of the skaters affected by that whole scandal in Salt Lake City. And he said, you know, it was at 12:30 at night, 2 hours after the event, and he said, if I can't figure out what these scores mean. He was still studying the scores at a table. He said, people at home in their living rooms are not going to be able to understand the scores, and that hurts the sport. And I think that is the takeaway. If people can't figure out why Yuna Kim lost without having to go through the algebra, then I think the competition is damaged to figure skating in that regard.
Mm. So maybe they might look at that for the next Olympics, revamping the scoring, how it's done.
My colleague Phil Hirsch talked to the head of the International Skating Union today, and that gentleman, Ottavio Cinquanta, was completely unaware that there was a controversy going on. So I wouldn't hold your breath for any kind of changes for the next time.
Okay. Stacey St. Clair, reporter with the Chicago Tribune, talking to us from Sochi. Thanks.
No problem.
Coming up, our weekly film segment. Today we talk about the disaster epic Pompeii, Miyazaki's new animated movie, and which movies should not have been nominated for Best Picture. That's coming up on Press Play.
wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
It's Press Play. I'm Madeline Brandt, and it's Friday, which means movies here on Press Play. And we have new releases and fresh news out of Hollywood with Alonzo Duralde. He's chief film critic for The Wrap. Hi.
Hello.
And Christy Lemire, film critic and co-host of the web series What the Flick.
Hi.
I like that. What the Flick.
We're very punny at What the Flick.
Indeed.
Okay, well, let's talk about Pompeii. Is that yay or nay? This is a sword and sandals epic.
Yeah, I'm very nay on it. And I like the idea of a disaster movie that is also a, you know, toga extravaganza. But it's Paul W.S. Anderson, the director of the Mortal Kombat movies and the Resident Evil movies. And he's not high on my list of fun guys. And this is not a fun movie.
It's not fun, but it's unintentionally hilarious.
True.
Like, I don't think it means to be funny, but, you know, giant fireballs are hurtling themselves at these beautiful people, and they'll stop to like cuddle and look longingly at one another's eyes and say, "You came back for me." And it's like, "Run, run, get out of there now! You're all gonna die."
If you
it's
hate,
so bad.
If you hate it, if you hated Titanic, you will have to go back and reevaluate that movie after you see Pompeii, because at least that one had Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah.
This one has the Game of Thrones guy and the girl from Sucker Punch, and they've got about one facial expression between them.
That's true, and it is like Titanic because there is that socioeconomic schism, like he's a slave from the wrong side of the tracks,
oh,
and
my gosh.
She's
it's
a beautiful
so
young princess.
Yeah, and Kiefer Sutherland is Billy Zane, but he's a senator. You know, it's, yeah.
Okay, now we have to hear a little bit of it from the trailer.
Place of corruption.
Kill them.
Temptation.
A slave looks at you as if he's in a dream, Cassia.
And a battle.
What is your name?
My name is Milo.
For survival.
Tomorrow we fight.
Come on, is it so bad? Could it be so bad it's good? Is it one of those? Or is it just so bad it's bad?
I wish. I don't know. I think it's so bad it's just bad.
Yeah, although, you know, there are those theaters now that serve alcohol, so find one if you must see this, and that's the. But lubricate yourself well.
Okay, so what else is out this weekend that maybe we should avoid?
There's a movie called 3 Days to Kill, which I have to admit Alonzo and I have not seen, because tellingly, it screened at the exact same moment in time as Pompeii.
And you chose Pompeii.
Well, I chose Pompeii.
It, you can always tell when they're trying to keep something from critical view. The new not showing it to the press is showing it to the press only opposite another movie you have to see.
And this is the Kevin Costner movie.
Right, right. And it's written by Luc Besson, I think. It's directed by McGee, who, you know, the Charlie's Angels guy who most recently did This Means War. From what I understand, it is a clumsy attempt to sort of be jokey and actiony at the same time. I think Kevin Costner is trying desperately to be the new Liam Neeson, but word is, from folks who've seen it, it's not really quite working.
Because Liam Neeson is the new Liam Neeson.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. Okay. It's a plane disaster movie.
Yeah, it's called Nonstop.
Nonstop. It's super crazy fun. I did that's opening next week. I got an early look at it, and I'm probably not even supposed to be talking about it yet, but I'm just going to say I had a blast.
But I keep seeing the ads for it,
yeah.
So they're really promoting it.
Yeah, and it's from the guy. He's reuniting with director Jean-Michel Seurat, who did his movie Unknown a few years ago, the one where he's got Amnesia and January Jones in that order.
And he did Orphan, which was super creepy.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's a hoop.
And who's the love interest?
Is it Julianne Moore?
Julianne Moore is love interest-ish. But yeah, this is, I was saying before, this is character actor airlines. The stewardesses are Lady Mary, Michelle Dockery from Downton Abbey, and Oscar nominee Lupita Nyong'o. And the fellow passengers include Scoot McNairy and Corey Stoll. So, you know, it is a plane chock full of talent.
Okay. How does he get texts on the plane? He gets text messages on the plane.
Because they keep the internet on, you know. They have
really?
That now
you
on
can
the
do
airplane.
That now.
Okay.
I know you have a child. You don't get out much, but it's a thing.
Okay, let's talk about a movie that people will actually want to go see, and that's Hayao Miyazaki's new movie, The Wind Rises. And here is a little snippet.
Remember this, Japanese boy. Airplanes are not tools for war. They're not for making money. Airplanes are beautiful dreams. Engineers turn dreams into reality.
Yes.
Arrivederci! We'll meet again!
This this is Miyazaki's last film.
Theoretically, yes.
And what did you think?
You know, I have not seen the English language dub version. I've seen the original Japanese version with subtitles. As a philosophical approach to all these films, I appreciate them better in the original Japanese. I think that it feels jarring to me quite often to hear the dubbed versions. I don't know. It seems tonally off somehow.
Well, they used to offer a choice. Like Disney would always run the Japanese version at least a couple times a week at the LCAP. So what I like to do actually the first time is see it dubbed just to take in all the visual space because Miyazaki's got so much going on and is such a master of his craft as an animator. And then I would see it the second time subtitled so that I didn't mind the words blocking the screen and then I could sort of take in the original voice cast. Yeah, I have not seen the English dub of this one yet either, but it's an extraordinary film. It's currently nominated for Best Animated Feature. I hope it's not his last film. He said this before, so I'm never completely trusting him on it.
But this seems kind of autobiographical, like he's really looking back at his career. I know it's not about an animator. It's about a guy who designs airplanes. But
right.
It
touches on a lot of his obsessions. I mean, if you look at his films from, Howl's Moving Castle, certainly... not so much Howl's Moving Castle, but Kiki's Delivery Service and Porco Rosso. Like, flight plays a big role, Castle in the Sky. This is probably the first movie I've ever seen that's a love letter to engineering, that really talks about the art and the visionary aspect of creating something new. Granted, the something new in this case is the airplane that wound up being the Japanese Zero, which bombed Pearl Harbor, and a lot of people sort of have issue with the fact that he's telling a story about someone who was the architect of destruction, even though that architect, as portrayed in this movie, that's not what he had in mind. He just wanted to build a new and better airplane.
And he does address that in the movie.
It is mentioned. But it's, it is visually gorgeous the way that Miyazaki films are. It is soaring, literally and figuratively, and it's really beautiful. I can't recommend that enough.
Yeah, the lighting is really beautiful, and you do find yourself in sort of the interesting position of rooting for this character's success, right? Mm-hmm. You see him grow up, you see him have these dreams, you see him study and work hard, and you want him to be good at the thing he dreams of, even though you know that ultimately the thing he dreams of is going to result in destruction. It's an interesting, uncomfortable place to put viewers, and I don't know how folks are going to respond to it.
The thing about this movie that I found different from his other movies is he abandons the fantastical as his last movie, Ponyo, the movie previous to this, was this amazing blend of fantasy and reality. And this doesn't have it. It's sort of straight up biopic in a sense.
Yeah, no, Ponyo is like drug induced.
Yeah.
Ponyo's wacky. But this is very much about literally the nuts and bolts of, his job and his day-to-day life and the woman he falls in love with. And it is rooted in a reality, definitely.
Yeah. But it still has that gorgeous Miyazaki. Mm-hmm.
Because just the dreams of flight have meant so much to him. Even just in telling this guy's story, he's able to incorporate that into what is generally a much more real world story than his usual films tend to tell.
Okay, Oscars are next weekend, and I wanted you both to pick the best picture nominee you hate the most. Because it's always more fun to hate them.
Right, yeah. We don't like anything, me and Alonzo. But I would say not necessarily hate this, but I'm not sure it belongs in the best picture category, and that is Philomena.
Okay, and that movie is sort of a real-life telling of a woman who puts her kid up for adoption and then goes to find it.
Right, it's a woman who, she's a young unwed mother, and she's working at a convent. And
she was sent to a convent because she got pregnant.
To have the child, and forced into labor, and then they take the child from her and adopt it out, and Judi Dench plays her as an adult and wants to find out what happened to that little boy. And Steve Coogan is the journalist who goes along with her to help her on this journey. And it's way more complicated than either of them ever expected. It's a lovely movie. Judi Dench is Judi Dench, and so she can elevate any material, but I'm not sure this is a best picture contender. You?
I'm going to go with Dallas Buyers Club. Mm-hmm. I do unabashedly love Matthew McConaughey's performance, but I think the movie tends to be kind of a crock. You can tell that the other characters in the film are all composites of actual real people, and they come off that sort of flatly and two-dimensionally. And frankly, 20 years after Philadelphia, to get a movie about AIDS whose central character is a homophobic straight guy as the hero, when if you look at documentaries like How to Survive a Plague, so much of the real stories of heroism in the early years years, the AIDS epidemic, where gay men and you know, people of color and women sort of taking control of their own health and their own options because the government and you know, the drug companies weren't helping at all, I find kind of offensive. And I would be more forgiving of that fact if the movie were better, but I find it really kind of stilted and TV movie-ish. So outside of McConaughey's performance, I don't think it's very good.
I'm not a huge fan of Jared Leto's performance.
Me neither.
I'm going to say that out loud.
You're in the minority.
We are very much in the minority. He's going to win the Oscar, but I find that performance really self-satisfied and very external and surfacey.
And kind of stereotypically drag queen-y.
Yeah, I think we're. I like to think that we're reaching an era where straight guys playing gay roles and playing trans roles like this is going to become the equivalent of blackface.
Oh, it's so brave.
Exactly. Oh, what a risk. What a gamble. Yeah.
He lost weight.
What a guaranteed Oscar nomination. You know, there are a ton of talented trans performers out there who could have played that role and should have played that role.
I would like to see Barkhad Abdi win Best Supporting Actor. Wouldn't that be a cool thing to happen? It's not going to happen for Captain Phillips. It's not going to happen.
Oh, right now.
Everyone loves Jared Leto, but I don't get it.
All right. Well, you heard it here first, I think. I think you heard it here first. Christy LeMaire, film critic, co-host of What the Flick, and Alonzo Duralde, chief film critic for The Wrap. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
So what's your pick for worst Best Picture nominee? Let's try that. Worst Best Picture nominee. You can call us and leave us a voicemail at 844-PRESS-PLAY, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, and we may play your comment at the end of today's show. Well, coming up, did Apple, Google, and other big tech companies conspire to not hire each other's employees? The Justice Department says yes, and that's against the law. Also, why Hollywood and Silicon Valley are getting involved in a lawsuit between two mommy bloggers. That's coming up. First, a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, it all started with an obscene gesture. A blogger who advocates for having babies at home sent a picture of herself flipping off the camera to another blogger, another woman who writes about obstetrics. What happened next took a turn for the litigious. And now some heavy hitters are involved. Hollywood on one side and Silicon Valley on the other. And at stake? Well, the future of copyright, you could say. LA Times national correspondent Evan Halper has been following the case, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Hello there, Madeline.
Well, tell us about the facts of this case. What happened after the home birth blogger sent that picture to the obstetrics blogger?
It's really complicated, and I'll try to distill it as best I can. But what happened here is that she didn't send the picture. She posted the picture on her own site, and it was, yes, of her giving the middle finger and saying to the other blogger, here's something for her to obsess about. And, of course, the other blogger took the picture, put it on her blog, and opined about it, at which point the blogger who gave the finger sent the internet service provider of the other blogger what's called a takedown warning, telling the service provider, I made this picture, this is mine, it's copyrighted, you need to take down that content or you can get sued under copyright law. And the internet service provider obliged, and then the blogger who was the subject of the hand gesture went to court and said, this is not the way copyright law is supposed to be used. You know, it's my right to speak out about this picture of someone giving me the finger, and this needs to be changed, and we need to limit how these takedown notices can be sent. And that got Hollywood concerned because these takedown warnings are something that the movie industry uses quite often.
So they're on the side of the home birth blogger who posted the kind of obscene gesture photo, to her right to have this photo private. But she posted it publicly, right?
Yeah, she posted it publicly, but she's saying it's hers, and thus the person who it was directed at didn't have a right to take it and put it on her own site. So, you know, it's one of these things where the lines of what's protected content and what's copyrighted and what, you know, what's for use is are blurred, and the industries get very interested in how the courts decide this, because ultimately, I mean, obviously the motion picture industry, Motion Picture Association of America, does not care so much about whether this blogger can send this takedown warning, but they don't want any court decisions that are going to undermine their ability to send out all the takedown warnings that they send out all the time.
And this case is taking place, unfolding in Boston, so a long way from California.
Yeah, exactly. A long way from California. But, you know, as the story pointed out, the Electronic Frontier Foundation showed up in the courthouse also, and that's becoming part of the headache for Hollywood. I mean, these kinds of cases where they would get involved in copyright law, not long ago they would be in the courtroom alone. There were not these other interests that had so much funding that were fighting them on this. And so Hollywood's finding it's having a tough time keeping the copyright protections the way it wants to keep them.
Okay, so the Electronic Frontier Foundation is representing the other side, Silicon Valley, and saying basically this other blogger has the right to post whatever she wants. Information should be free, kind of thing.
That's exactly right, Madeline. And, you know, this court case is just one of many. And I use it in the article as an example of how the Motion Picture Association and other Hollywood interests are having a tough time keeping things the way they want to keep them. And this is happening right at a time, you know, so the courts are making all these rulings on copyright laws, and some of them are not going the way that Hollywood wants. And now Congress is opening a whole new discussion on copyright law. A lot of it was written before the internet even existed, or at least was widely used, or even computer use was widely used. It dates back to the mid-1970s.
So meanwhile, they're fighting every single battle they can in the courts?
Well, they're winding up getting dragged into court. So in some ways, this whole battle right now is playing out in courts, and the judges are often reluctant. They're not happy at having to sort of guide these policies that again, were written before the internet was widely used. But Congress has been reluctant to step in. It got burned when it started to do so a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
There was the Stop Online Piracy Act, and Hollywood was pushing it hard, and it didn't seem like it was a very risky thing to get involved in. But there was such a blowback from the public. I think 8 million people contacted Congress in one form or another. Wikipedia went dark for the day saying, if this legislation passes, this is what it's going to be like. We're not going to be able to do the things on the internet that we've been able to do. You're not going to be able to do the things that you come to the internet to do. Scholars disagree on how true that was, but the end result was a lot of angry people in the public, and the legislation died.
Well, also, I think what's happening now since then is the blurring of the lines. When you think of a case or a company like Netflix, which is an online company, in one part of its business, it provides streaming content, but it's also providing content made in Hollywood. So how are these lines being blurred?
Well, it's a good point you raised, because that's the point that Hollywood keeps raising. Because in this discussion, the tech people, the free marketeers, some of the Silicon Valley firms keep saying that Hollywood has taken copyright protections, which were supposed to be something that foster innovation, to give people just enough incentive to create, but not to inhibit innovation by putting protections on creative properties for so long that they never become part of the public domain. And that Hollywood has kind of abused the process and has just lengthened it and how long these copyrights last, and that the free internet needs these restrictions to be scaled back some. But what the people in Hollywood say is, look at Netflix, look at Amazon Prime, look at all Hulu, look at all these services where they follow all the rules, and Hollywood producers and Hollywood studio executives say, we're not trying to inhibit innovation at all. We just are protecting the rights of creators.
So getting back to this case in Boston of the two warring bloggers, did they actually solicit Hollywood and Silicon Valley lawyers to weigh in on their behalfs, or was it kind of a surprise addition to their legal team?
You know, I actually don't know the answer to that question. I mean, they were friends of the court briefs that were written. I know that both places, Electronic Frontier Foundation and the Motion Picture Association, obviously have a lot of lawyers on staff who very closely monitor these kinds of cases, and this one showed up in federal court and involved takedown notices. So they petitioned the court to get involved, and the court allowed them to. At this point, Hollywood actually has prevailed. The use of takedown notices has not been altered by the courts. They said what this blogger did in demanding that this picture that she had produced, making an obscene gesture to another blogger, not be allowed to be used by the other blogger.
Oh, so Hollywood wins this round.
Hollywood did win a round here, yes.
Okay, a rare win, I guess, in recent times
right.
for Hollywood on this topic. Evan Halper, national correspondent with the LA Times, thanks.
Thanks for having me on, Madeline.
Back in 2005, some of the biggest tech CEOs in Silicon Valley, Apple's Steve Jobs, Google's Eric Schmidt, and others, allegedly made a secret agreement not to hire away each other's employees. The U.S. Justice Department got wind of that pact, and that federal investigation spurred a lawsuit by some of the employees at those companies going forward. Now, Mark Ames is a senior editor for Pando Daily. That's an online news site covering the tech world, and he's here now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, how did this alleged secret agreement between these huge companies come about?
Well, the genesis of it, it was in the mid-1980s when George Lucas from Lucasfilm spun off Pixar, and Steve Jobs became the head of Pixar. And Lucas said, he was sort of the Obi-Wan Kenobi of this whole secret wage suppression agreement. He said, I don't like competition for workers, so let's not poach each other's workers, let's inform each other, and because otherwise it affects margins too much. So Pixar and Lucasfilm maintained that agreement for the next two decades. And then fast forward now to 2005, and the tech market is starting to really heat up, and the competition for highly skilled tech engineers and programmers and stuff is starting to push wages up through the roof. And at this time in early 2005, Steve Jobs, this is all revealed in the court documents from the investigation and so on, Jobs sends an email to Sergey Brin, one of the founders of Google, and says, stop trying to recruit our employees or we'll go to war with you. And Google at that time was, you know, it just had its IPO. It was on the up and up. And they didn't want to go to war with Steve Jobs. And so they agreed to stop poaching each other's employees and then to go further than that and not cold call or recruit each other's employees. And from that genesis, it wound up spreading very quickly thanks to these interlocking boards of directors relationships between Google and Intel, Adobe, Intuit, and so on. It spread to a total of seven companies at least, all of which agreed not to cold call, recruit, or solicit each other's employees. And the effect of this, in the language of the Department of Justice and the lawsuit and so on, and experts, the effect of this obviously is to suck information out of the labor market so that employees don't even know what they're worth because no one's calling them trying to recruit them.
And this is illegal? This is illegal activity?
Yes. This
what
is
laws
illegal
does it violate?
It's a violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act and the Clayton Antitrust Act. It's a monopoly activity, and it was done in secret. And in fact, the CEOs themselves knew that this was illegal. I mean, there's an email from Eric Schmidt, who was the CEO of Google at the time, to the head of his HR department saying, let's not put this in writing. This could lead to lawsuits. Let's keep all, you know, these agreements as gentlemen's agreements, for now. Later, these became more formalized. And I'm working on a story now that without getting into it before I actually publish it, I think this spread well beyond Silicon Valley. It began in Silicon Valley, but it wound up growing in leaps and bounds and spread well beyond Silicon Valley. And as I said, this is, you know, when we think of antitrust monopoly activities, we usually think of price fixing affecting the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't really think about how this price fixing or, say, wage fixing affecting employees at a time when competition for skilled workers might be driving their wages up a lot.
Right,
and that's
right.
What this suit is about.
Right. I mean, I see what you mean. I think for the general public, when you look at the workers that they're competing over, these are workers who are already making a lot of money, right, in the six figures?
Some of them, many of them, but a lot of these agreements involve the entire, I mean, right down to the secretary, you know, receptionist,
oh, really?
Administrative assistant. So this covered the whole band for some of the of these cross agreements. It covered the whole band of employees. I should add that eBay separately is also being sued by both the state of California and the federal government for a similar arrangement with Intuit and presumably others. I mean, eBay does come up in the court documents in this case as well. Meg Whitman, who's now the head of HT, calling up Eric Schmidt to complain about about how Google was driving up wages, even at her company.
Meg Whitman, who ran for California governor.
Exactly, and she headed eBay at the time, and now she's the head of HP.
So now there's this lawsuit, and it's brought on behalf of some of the workers. What could happen
right.
at this out of this lawsuit? Because the Justice Department settled with these companies, and they probably didn't admit guilt, right, as part
exactly.
of the settlement. So very quickly, we only have a few seconds left. What's going to happen, what could happen as a result of this lawsuit?
Right, so the big tech companies tried to have this not certified as a class action. They lost, and the trial's going forward. It begins in May. What could happen, according to some estimates I've seen, we could be talking about $9-10 billion in stolen wages, essentially. Because remember,
in the billions.
Because remember also that the penalties in antitrust lawsuits like this are tripled.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Fascinating story. Mark Ames is senior editor for the online news site Pando Daily. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And speaking of fascinating, Warren Olney is here now to give us a preview of what's up at 1 o'clock.
We have a fascinating show coming up at 1 o'clock. It's an update on what's going on in Ukraine, and some very interesting developments have occurred today. There is, in fact, a deal between the president and the political opposition. Nobody knows yet if the people on the street are going to buy it. But already the parliament has passed some new laws. He's going to be challenged to sign those or not. And it appears that Vladimir Putin is stepping away and not supporting the president.
Big development.
A very big development. And also, there are some very interesting long-range possibilities. One is, according to one of our guests, that Russia might collapse in the same way that Ukraine might collapse, being divided. And that's from a person who thinks that both countries are kleptocracies, where the political leadership is stealing from the people. But then there's another equally depressing long-term scenario, which is a new Cold War between Vladimir Putin's Russia and the European Union, and by extension, at least, of the United States. We'll also take a look at Sochi and how well it's worked out there for Vladimir Putin while everything's falling apart 100 miles away in Ukraine.
All right. Look forward to that. 1 o'clock, To the Point, Warren Olney. Thank you. And coming up on Press Play, why Orange County is allowing a lot more people to apply for permits to carry concealed weapons. That's next on Press Play.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Until recently, it was up to your local sheriff to decide if you had the, quote, good cause and good moral character to carry a concealed weapon here in California. But last week, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that good cause rules were too restrictive. That ruling is on hold right now and may never go into effect because it's being reviewed. But Orange County Sheriff Sandra Hutchins announced yesterday that her department would follow the court's decision, which means loosening the restrictions on who can carry a gun. Lieutenant Jeff Halleck is spokesman for the Orange County Sheriff. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, first, explain to us what this phrase good cause means and why the court found that the good cause rules were too restrictive.
Prior to the opinion last week, good cause was defined or was interpreted by the Orange County Sheriff and a lot of other sheriffs as something more than simply self-defense or self-protection, because in a sense, anybody and everybody could justify that as good cause. So we were looking for some additional information or some additional good cause to justify issuing the permit. However, as a result of the most recent Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals opinion last Friday, that particular court said that, in fact, simply self-defense or self-protection equated to good cause.
Okay. And then the other criterion is good moral character.
That's correct.
And how is that determined?
You know, again, it's subjective, just as good cause was prior to this opinion. It's an evaluation that needs to be made by each individual sheriff. Specifically, there's an interview and a background process that goes along with a CCW's application. And part of that is just looking at the person and making a determination. I mean, largely they look at your criminal history, but there's no real black and white answer to that. It's an overall evaluation based on information provided on an application, reference letters, and so forth.
All right. So how many people in Orange County have concealed carry weapon permits?
As of statistics that I gathered yesterday, the County of Orange, the Orange County Sheriff, has issued 906 concealed weapon permits.
And do you expect more to be issued now?
Potentially. If this particular opinion is upheld, that would then allow for more applicants to move through the process and the potential for issuing more concealed weapon permits. I can tell you that we've had a huge influx of applicants over the last several days. There's an interview process that is part of, you know, applying for the CCW, and I know as of yesterday, we were scheduled through mid to the end of May for interviews.
So a flood meaning how many?
You know, I don't have exact numbers, but, you know, you figure you can only handle a certain amount of interviews every day. We have a person or a couple of people dedicated to managing that CCW process. So you can do a handful every day, and we're scheduled through May. So if you do the math, I mean, there's, I would say, up over 100 people that have initially, you know, applied as a result of this most recent opinion.
So this recent opinion, as we said earlier, is being postponed. It's being it's not being put into effect right now as it's being reviewed by the larger court, and it may be appealed. But Sheriff Hutchins went ahead anyway and said, okay, well, we're going to follow what the court said. Why did she do that?
Well, I think the sheriff here in Orange County, she's dedicated to, regardless of what her personal opinions are, she is committed to following the law. So in her opinion, based on the ruling by the Ninth Circuit Friday afternoon, as of today, or for at least for the next few weeks until the court reviews this opinion, that is the law as we speak. And so that's why she's accepting applications for good cause as it relates to self-protection and self-defense. However, she is well aware that that could be overturned or that could be withdrawn over the next couple of weeks. And once, if and when that is done, then she will revisit it if necessary.
I guess I'm a little confused, because if the ruling is on hold, how is it then the law?
Well, it's an opinion of the court, meaning that if it's not withdrawn or there is no appeal, then it will become law, if that makes sense. So,
but currently, right now, it is not law, or is it?
Well, the opinion, yeah, you could make an argument that it is law, and that's why we're moving forward.
Or you could argue that we're going to wait and see how this transpires before we issue more permits.
That would also be an option. I think what's important to remember is that the application process takes several weeks to get through. I think that the expectation is that we will get some more clarity on the issue in the next couple of weeks, and it could go either way. So we're prepared to confront the issue either way, whether the opinion of the court remains or if it's overturned or withdrawn, we'll then revisit it and move forward accordingly.
Well, she is an elected official, and this is a conservative constituency, so it seems like a smart political move.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to really get into the politics of it. I mean, what she has said is she's committed to following the law regardless of what her personal opinions are. So the reason that she has made the shift in terms of accepting personal protection and self-defense as good cause is strictly based on the opinion of the court on Friday. If that is withdrawn or changed, she will then shift to whatever the law is as a result of that.
I wonder, though, once the horse has left the barn, can you get it back in the sense that if this court ruling is vacated or successfully appealed, then how do you get back those concealed carry permits that you've issued?
Well, that'll be a timing thing. If something is reversed or withdrawn in the next few weeks, there won't be much of an issue because those applicants who are justifying their good cause simply as self-protection or self-defense, they'll still be in that application process and will have never been issued a permit. If it's 6 months or 8 months down the road and there are CCW permits that have been issued as a result of, you know, self-protection or self-defense, that will then be an issue that the sheriff will have to confront in terms of, you know, whether or not she's going to revoke those permits immediately or she will just let those expire and not renew them.
Jeff Halleck is spokesman for the Orange County Sheriff. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Jolie Myers is here now. Easily the best part of the show when you come in here to share the mail.
Well, thank you, Madeline. Easily the best part of my day coming in here. So we talked earlier with our film critics about the worst Best Picture nominees.
Yep.
Kirk called in with his nomination for worst Best Picture nominee. First of all, major spoiler alert ahead, you guys. Number two in the show after Olympics. Major spoiler alert. So here's what he had to say.
My choice for worst Best Picture is Gravity. It just didn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. I did see a lot of space trash flying around. But the bottom line is, the main character fell out of outer space, landed in a rice paddy, and was able to get up and walk away and make sense of the whole thing. That just doesn't seem realistic.
It is realistic for you to call us and leave us a voicemail. It might go on air. 1-844.
Wait, is that the one reason he didn't want it to be the Best Picture nominee?
Just I think it's a pretty valid reason, paddy? To be perfectly honest. Yeah,
it's about rebirth. You know,
we've got a water, gravity defender here.
Water coming. Well, I'm just trying to maybe point to something a little larger than just a rice paddy.
Well, we got a tweet from Horacio in Hawthorne who said that he was more upset about a movie that was not nominated, Inside Llewyn Davis. So he said it was a travesty to only have it be nominated for sound mixing and cinematography.
Did you see that?
I loved it. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
Oh, fantastic.
Okay. Rentable, hopefully.
Rentable. Soon Netflix,
enough.
Y'all.
Yeah. And that's it?
That's it. That's all we got today.
Okay. All right. That's it. And oh, I see the time is running out. If you need to contact us, well, you can email pressplay@kcrw, Twitter @kcrwpressplay, my own personal @themadbrand. And that's it for me. Warren Olney is up next with To The Point. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Monday. Have a great weekend.